Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
Every 25th of April, we mark the date the Australian and New Zealand forces landed on the beach at Gallipoli. Now, for some of us, of course, this was the birth of the Australian national identity. Not so for others, but in 1916, the Gallipoli or Dardanelles campaign was seen by a number as little more than a disaster. After 8 months of intense fighting, the Allied forces had failed to take the peninsula and retreated, but not before more than 300,000 casualties amongst the French, British, Australian and New Zealand troops alone. There was outrage over the failure, with the Dardanelles Commission set up to investigate what went wrong. This was a British commission. It found the campaign was poorly planned, the difficulties underestimated, and that it was hampered by personality clashes and procrastination at high levels. The commission might never have happened, though, if it wasn't for one Keith Murdoch. Now, Keith Murdoch was the father of Rupert Murdoch, and he played a key role in smuggling out much of the original evidence that led to the withdrawal and, of course, the eventual inquiry, the Dardanelles Commission. Jatinder Mahon's been looking at the role of Keith Murdoch in the Dardanelles Commission from a British perspective. He's an assistant professor in history at Hong Kong's Baptist University and joins us tonight. Jatinder, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on the show.
Terrific to have you with us too. What was the, in 1916, it was hard to talk about public perceptions, isn't it? Because there was so little information available to the public in 1916 about what was going on, was there?
Very true, very true. I mean, obviously it was wartime and censorship was very much in full play. So, I mean, it was even controversial to even hold a commission looking at, as you outlined, a military campaign that was ultimately a failure during the war still taking place. So yeah, it was quite a controversial thing to even happen in the first place.
Mm. Yeah. Well, tell us about what was Keith Murdoch, who was a journalist, what was he doing in Gallipoli anyway?
Well, it's quite interesting. So he was basically the unofficial eyes and ears of Australian Prime Minister at the time, Andrew Fisher. So they actually had quite a friendship, which went back some years. So Andrew Fisher was in the Melbourne congregation of Keith Murdoch's father, who was a Scottish Presbyterian minister. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they had quite a close relationship. He was heading to take up a position in the UK, and Andrew Fisher asked him to kind of drop off at Gallipoli on the way to kind of see what was going on.
As you do, as you do.
As you do. And to kind of gorge the kind of opinion and feelings of Australian soldiers and officers as well.
So he had imprimatur to do this. I mean, because he would have needed the cooperation of the army to do that. And he had that.
Exactly.
He had that, did he?
Exactly. Yeah, so you had to kind of get a license from the British kind of senior command. So only kind of authorised journalists could be at the scene, because obviously, you know, it was a military campaign and they didn't want to, you know, military secrets, so to speak, to be kind of, on public display, to say the least. He was officially kind of asked by Andrew Fisher to kind of check out what was going on. And yeah, as you said, he wrote this very explosive letter.
Yeah, let's get there in a moment, because when did he arrive, Keith Murdoch? What point in the campaign did he arrive?
So, I mean, it wasn't right at the beginning, but it was kind of after, you know, the Australians had got there and, they had suffered quite a lot of casualties. And especially those that were injured were also dying as well, which was a real cause for concern. It was not a good time, to say the least.
No, exactly, exactly.
I mean, campaign.
That's right. The landing's in April, and then I think he writes to Fisher in September. So by this stage, of course, it's clear that the whole thing is a disaster.
Exactly.
Murdoch quite quickly made up. Well, not thought this is no good at all. What did he do? So he wrote to Andrew Fisher, didn't he?
Yeah. So it's a bit complicated.
Because it's a funny thing. I mean, these days, of course, a correspondent would immediately publish online and then it would go straight to air. But that
exactly.
wasn't
Everybody
the case back. That wasn't the case back then because you really couldn't do that, could you?
No. So initially, what he actually tried to do was to smuggle out a letter by Ashmead Bartlett, who was a British journalist, who had actually written quite a critical letter about the campaign. He was kind of supposed to pass it on to the British authorities to kind of, escape the censor. But he got caught, and apparently he blamed a rival of Bartlett, of another newspaper, for kind of dobbing him in, so to speak. So that letter was confiscated, but then what he proceeded to do was write his own explosive letter, which in some ways rhetorically was even more kind of damning than the Ashmead Bartlett letter. And it was that letter that he officially had kind of written to Andrew Fisher. But Andrew Fisher actually said to him, look, you know, you need to get this to the British cabinet. They need to know what's going on. So he gave him permission, even though it was, in theory, a letter addressed personally to him, to actually share it with the British kind of political authority, so to speak.
Mm. Yeah, it became instrumental, didn't it, in the British cabinet's decision to withdraw from the Dardanelles?
Exactly. Even though I think, you know, it was kind of treated with some kind of suspicion. Mm. And I think, you know, quite a few members of the cabinet did kind of suggest that, oh, well, he's exaggerating. Hyperbole. But, you know, I think because there was also other evidence alongside it, which kind of, basically supported its basic kind of argument, which was, as you said, the campaign had been a disaster for various reasons, and it was just kind of continuing in that direction, and they needed a change of leadership at the top to really shake things up.
Yeah.
Did
Murdoch lay the blame at anyone's feet?
It was quite interesting. So, I mean, he did kind of highlight the British officers, especially for, you know, kind of great strategic areas. And obviously the person right at the top was Ian Hamilton.
Mm.
So he really did take quite a lot of brunt of his kind of anger. But not only him, you know, also other kind of officers under him as well. And I think there's this kind of famous quote of him saying that, you know, they're kind of cubs, you know, trying to play at war was his kind of metaphor that he used. So, you know, that really conjures up a certain image, not a good one, of the British officer class at the campaign.
Yeah. Yes, of course, there was a disaster at the Gallipoli landings, but of course, you know, further south, the British had suffered tremendous losses too, and hugely much greater in landings they'd attempted. So it wasn't going well anywhere. I'm talking with Jatinder Mann, an historian in Hong Kong at Hong Kong's Baptist University, there about the Murdoch letter, the Keith Murdoch letter to Andrew Fisher in 1916 about the disastrous state of affairs in Gallipoli and the subsequent Dardanelles Commission, which, you might think that the current Murdochs are the only Murdochs ever to have appeared before a royal commission, or a commission of inquiry. Not true. The first one was Keith Murdoch, the journalist who was at Gallipoli. So Andrew Fisher at the time, the Dardanelles Commission gets set up because the British government set up this commission of inquiry. Andrew Fisher wasn't any longer Prime Minister, was he?
That's right. So he'd actually been replaced by Billy Hughes. Back in Australia, but he had been appointed as the Australian High Commissioner to London, to the UK. So he was in London at the time. And I think because of his, you know, the fact that he was Australian Prime Minister at the time of the campaign, that, you know, he kind of seemed like a good member of the of the commission, and certainly to kind of
some might say today, let's just say, a massive conflict of interest. I mean, he's the Prime Minister, who committed troops to the Gallipoli campaign, and now he's on a commission of inquiry into why it's such a disaster. I mean, you wouldn't think it would pass muster as an appointment today, but you're right. I mean, he was kind of just there in the right place, wasn't he?
Exactly. No, you're totally right. You know, I think he certainly someone in his position wouldn't be asked today, because that would be an obvious conflict of interest. But I think, you know, one of the reasons why he, you know, did accept the invitation was because that, you know, he didn't expect Australia to be blamed for anything because, you know, Australia had sent the troops. They were under British command, essentially, during that campaign. So, you know, if there was going to be any blame, it was going to be on the British end rather than the Australian end. Although his appointment was controversial because he was appointed by Minister of Defence Pearce, who was acting Prime Minister in Australia at the time, because Billy Hughes was actually returning from the UK, funnily enough. So he was on the high seas. So it was actually Pearce that approved his appointment. And, you know, there has been some kind of discussion that if Billy Hughes was in Canberra, or in Melbourne, I should say, at the time, as it was, you know, the seat of the capital, he actually wouldn't have allowed Fisher to be a part of the commission for you know, perhaps, you know, conflict of interest reasons, but I think perhaps more so he still saw him as a political rival, and he didn't perhaps want him to use the commission to perhaps further his own political ambitions.
Mm. So tell us about the commission itself. What did Murdoch, both Murdoch and Fisher, did Fisher acquit himself well at the commission in terms of defending Australia's interests?
Oh, very much so. And I think that's probably the most significant kind of point that myself and my co-author of the article, which what we're kind of talking about is based, Carl Bridge, make, is that he actually, and there's, you know, numerous instances of this, he makes the consistent argument that Australia is a self-governing dominion. You know, it has the right to act in its own interests, and it has the right to have accountability from the British imperial authorities. So yeah, you know, he consistently made that point. And this very much kind of tied in with Murdoch's testimony, because he was given quite a grilling by a lot of the other members of the commission who were British, by and large. And quite often, Fisher would intervene. He would ask leading questions. He would actually even come to his aid, you know, if Murdoch was really put on the spot. So yeah, you know, you can see that there was something going on here. There was definitely an intention on Fisher's part to kind of, yeah, like I said, argue that Australia was a self-governing dominion, and to emphasize this point. I mean, obviously firmly within the British Empire, but, you know, it did have a sense of its own kind of identity and interests.
Yeah. What about Murdoch's performance? How did he perform?
Very interesting. So he, you know, as I was saying, this letter that he wrote was very explosive. And actually another thing that kind of rubbed up the British quite a bit was he was quite critical of British soldiers in quite derogative terms, I have to say. So, you know, that didn't go down well, unsurprisingly, amongst the British as well. But, you know, in his testimony to, in front of the commission, he was trying to qualify some of those remarks and said, oh, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't have gone that far, or perhaps I shouldn't have, you know, maybe used those words, you know, in hindsight. So there was certainly some kind of little bit of backtracking in terms of the language he used. But, you know, he stuck to his guns when it came to his main point that, you know, the campaign had been a disaster. The responsibility predominantly lay on the feet of the British officers in command, but also politicians as well, because, you know, I think that was the other point that he was trying to make, that obviously Britain, in comparison to Germany, who it was fighting at the time, was a democracy, and politicians actually had the ultimate power. They told military officers what to do. So, you know, there was blame to go around, really. It wasn't just the military officers that were incompetent, but the politicians. And, you know, of course, Winston Churchill comes to mind, and because that certainly wasn't a proud moment for him in terms of the military campaign. You know, he was kind of responsible.
No, exactly.
You know, it's kind of
the big picture. That's right. The Gallipoli campaign damaged Churchill a lot, didn't it? It also damaged.
It did damage
Fisher too in the end, too, didn't it? But it raised Murdoch's profile hugely, didn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate, because if you look at the kind of, you know, what happened to them afterwards, as I was kind of hinting at before, you know, I think one of the reasons Fisher wanted to be on the commission was to kind of, you know, maintain his legacy. But he was also keeping an eye on Australian political developments. So, of course, you had the conscription referenda going on in Australia, hugely divisive. So, you know, quite like a lot of Australians, you know, didn't see Hughes kind of lasting very much longer. So I think he did kind of think, well, this could be an opportunity for me to return back to power as Prime Minister of Australia. But sadly, that didn't happen. Hughes went on to win a huge majority with his nationalist government, even though he lost the referendum, or even the second one. But yeah, you're right. Murdoch actually went on from strength to strength. So, you know, this really raised his profile. He went on to become editor of the Melbourne Herald and then proprietor. And you could say that, you know, the foundations of the current kind of Murdoch empire, so to speak, you know, can be seen here. He certainly went on from strength to strength. But yeah, sadly for Fisher, he didn't actually live much longer beyond the first world.
No, was there much other fallout from the Dardanelles Commission? I mean, it was widely seen as a disaster, wasn't it? Was there much other fallout?
Yeah. I mean, this is a great quote that we mentioned in the article about faint blame, you know, being passed all around or something. So, you know, I think a lot of people, perhaps even including Fisher, expected it to be a whitewash. You know, there wasn't going to be some sort of damning indictment of the British military class or even key politicians. And that's exactly what happened. But like I said, the fact that it even happened during wartime was significant in itself. But, you know, Fisher, again, you know, refused to sign the final report. His argument was he hadn't attended enough sessions to warrant that. But again, I think he was thinking more legacy mode. He didn't particularly want to be associated with a commission that basically had been a whitewash in terms of kind of apportioning blame. I think the significance from an Australian perspective is that this is very much an early example of a Australian politician or former politician or statesman kind of articulating Australia's place, changing place in the British Empire, and, you know, having a greater awareness of itself and its own interests. So a lot's been made about, you know, the Treaty of Versailles, Billy Hughes, you know, insisting on signing Australia's name individually, not just as a part of the British Empire. But, you know, this is before that. This is a few years before that. You have someone on numerous instances, you know, articulating this argument, which certainly kind of continued after the war, and you know, with the Balfour Declaration and the Statute of Westminster as well.
Yeah, interesting. All right, Jatinder, terrific to talk. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Jatinder Mann is an historian, assistant professor in history at Hong Kong's Baptist University, and author of an interesting article about the whole matter in the Royal Australian Historical Society.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.